I knew I wanted to make a piece on psychedelic healing. It's a topic I've heard a lot about lately from people I trust in the field who have said, this is something we should be more aware of. It can be effective sometimes when nothing else has worked. But it seemed like a little bit of a mystery to me. I had all these thoughts floating around in my head that I didn't know exactly if they were right. So if you're like me and you have these preconceived notions about psychedelics, but haven't experienced them for yourself, I'm going to ask that you suspend those beliefs just for a minute, or more precisely for 30 minutes, because you might be off. There might be more to it. I'm Tobin Richardson, a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And buckle up, maybe dim the lights, because we're going on a real journey here. In order to really understand the impact of psychedelics, I knew I wanted to talk to someone who'd been on the client side of psychedelic treatment. And that's how I came across Emily Bierbauer, who's a social worker who is very open about her use of ketamine. She pursued it in an attempt to find relief after her 11-year-old son died suddenly. And if you've heard of ketamine, you might know it's not exactly a psychedelic, at least not technically. It's a medicine with this interesting history because it was developed and received FDA approval as an anesthetic, but it also has this disassociative effect that's similar to psychedelics. And so now it's often used off-label for that purpose. It's kind of like this legal loophole because natural psychedelic substances like mushrooms in many places are illegal. And so ketamine and other similar pharmaceuticals can now sometimes be the only legal way to get psychedelic relief. So Emily thought, I'm going to try it. Here's her story.
I got my first infusion. It would have been in February of 2023. In December of 2022, my 11-year-old son died. Totally unexpectedly, he had epilepsy and was getting ready for school, said he felt funny, had a brief seizure to cardiac arrest, and died in the living room. And so I got them for, essentially post-traumatic stress, right? So I think what kind of swayed me to do it was knowing that I needed some rapid relief, knowing that, you know, death of my son was still pretty fresh. And I didn't feel like I could tolerate trauma therapy at the time. I couldn't wait 6 to 8 weeks for a 30% chance that an antidepressant would work. And I needed something quick and now. So yeah. And I got them actually, the psychiatrist I went through was actually who my surviving son sees. He's a psychedelic guy. He's always like, you should microdose with shrooms. I'm like, that seems like a lot, you know? And like, if I had to do anything more than an assessment, which I did with him, it was an hour long assessment, that would have been too many steps to kind of access it. It was interesting too, because, you know, I would read about the things and I was definitely not wanting a super spiritual experience. I'll be totally honest. I don't want to see or feel connected to anything. And I was a little bit worried that it was going to be over mystical in a way, and I just wasn't in a place. I didn't want to have a see my son. I didn't want any of that to happen. So I was a little bit anxious that it was going to be this big emotional experience, and I, if anything, I was kind of anxious about what that would be like.
Can you I know that this is impossible, but I do think people really want to understand what it's like when it takes
effect. I know. But the only thing I can tell them is I can compare it to other substances. Cause it's kind of like shrooms, you know? It's a dissociation and it's a separation from yourself and your environment, but it's not really sedation. So you know, I think with the infusions, your eyes are closed and you probably appear sleeping, but your brain is not sleeping. It's just disconnected and kind of floating. So it's fairly intense. It's not something that you could like fight through and try to ground yourself. I think if you were to try to keep your, if you open your eyes or whatever, that can kind of ground you a little bit, but it's blurry. I mean, it's an anesthetic. So it's kind of like a floating through space type feeling.
Okay. So I think some people might think that that process of disassociation, like, sounds scary or sounds like,
I was worried what that would be like going in, but part of ketamine just biologically, right, does diminish your anxiety. So I think it would be scary, except what's happening in your brain is releasing chemicals that would lessen the anxiety anyway, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's definitely not scary.
Okay. And how long did your process of like feeling this disassociation last?
Once the medicine's done, it's done. Okay. So you come back, I mean, and things start to get clear, and your music starts to sound like music again, that's coming from the outside. Cause when you're listening to the music, you got to be in control of your playlist. I'll say that. Like, I can see it getting kind of heavy if you like go way off. Right. But your music, it's like coming from your brain while you're getting the infusion, and as it's wearing it off, it's coming out of your headphones. You got to do it, man. I don't know. like that's the thing. It's the hardest thing to explain.
So it's wrapping up. The music is coming from the outside again. I'm really curious, like, the next hour, day, week, like, then what changes? What's it like in those three periods of time?
Well, so it's different, you know, when you're first onboarding with the ketamine, you're going to do another one. I was doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then since then, I do them like every 6 weeks-ish. There's definitely just an improvement in mood and energy, and I noticed like my vision seemed better, like colors seemed brighter, sound sounded better, time made, I mean, because it was hard, because I got it in such a almost not even post-traumatic stress. I was still like in the first 90 days, it was still almost like an acute stress period, where I was still very disoriented. I just started going back to work. I, you know, was very days seemed either really long or short, or, you know, it could be Wednesday and Monday seemed like it was 6 months ago. And so I started to feel more regulated and grounded, and things seemed more real. So I actually then would have less kind of dissociation, depersonalization as a result of the ketamine, which makes you dissociate. Yeah. Well, because that's really like a, you know, like that's a post-traumatic stress symptom, is the not feeling real and kind of feeling totally, you know. So I definitely felt substantially more present, and more kind of connected, and mood was much better. It's not a cure, you know, and I think that is, you know, people, I think sometimes think it's getting a little bit snake oily, like you do ketamine and it's going to solve all your problems. And that's a little bit of, I mean, that's a bit of an overshoot, you know, but it does work. I mean, I don't take an antidepressant otherwise. I don't take medication otherwise other than that. I feel like, especially when you're looking at like post-traumatic stress type symptoms, it's definitely easier to be less avoidant in, like, I would say like the first week to 10 days after like a ketamine infusion is a pretty sweet spot when it comes to being able to tolerate more and look at things in ways that are less scary. That's for sure a thing.
How has like your experience with ketamine, if at all, changed you as a clinician?
So I definitely suggest it for people when I don't think it would have been a risk I would have been willing to take if I hadn't had, you know, an experience myself where I'd seen it be effective. I think just being on the other side in general stops me from overanalyzing and putting too much of my own subjective interpretations into things. But I certainly feel like I understand mental health issues in a way I didn't before, especially depression and how that can impact functioning.
Up next, you'll hear from Dr. Dee Bonney, who's a physician who's seen firsthand the impact ketamine treatment has had on patients who are struggling with depression and anxiety. Dr. Bonney's a former ER doctor who now owns and operates a primary care practice, which is focused on functional medicine. He's thought a lot about brain health from a physiological perspective, which for me shed a whole new light on the topic. I interviewed him at his clinic, which is why the audio here sounds a little different, but here he is.
I mean, sometimes it's 100% reduction. I had a guy whose PHQ-9 was 19, his GAD-7 was 17, and before his fourth infusion, PHQ-9 was down to 4 or 5, but his GAD-7 was 0. And he told me, he goes, yeah, Saturday I texted my buddies. I said, so wait, not waking with crippling anxiety? That's just what normal people do. So I had a guy text me in October, the day after his third infusion. He said, if this is what happiness feels like, I've never been happy a day in my life.
What is it that changes it? So like, yeah. Can you talk about from a biological
Absolutely.
Perspective?
So it kind of comes back, Tobin, to like, we got to stop talking about mental health and think about brain health. Like literally, if the brain is healthy, these issues go away. And so it's like, why do we get depression and anxiety? I mean, if you look at the data, we're told it's a serotonin deficiency or it's a chemical imbalance. Those don't really play out great in the literature. Yes, SSRIs work to a degree, but 40% of the population doesn't respond to them. And the other 60% often doesn't respond great. I mean, if you look at them over a longer time horizon than maybe 12 weeks or so, they don't really significantly outperform placebo. So what's going on in the brain if it's not a serotonin deficiency or chemical imbalance? I think it's a couple of things. We know that depression and anxiety are disorders of inflammation. So they've actually measured these inflammatory markers in the brain and they're elevated when people have depression and anxiety versus those who don't. And that's probably one of the reasons why cleaning up your diet, omega-3s, exercise can move the needle to a degree. I mean, as you guys probably know, exercise has been shown to be as effective at treating mild to moderate depression as SSRIs. Well, one of the things that exercise does is it boosts a chemical called BDNF. It's like Miracle-Gro for the brain, brain-derived neurotropic factor, so neurotropic as to grow. So BDNF plays a role in how these therapies improve depression and anxiety. So I think why we get depression and anxiety, inflammation, but then also it's loss of neural connections in the brain. And I think this is really important. So we have neurons in the brain. One end of a neuron is a dendrite. So that's like, they call them dendritic spines or like finger-like projections, but they really kind of look like twigs off of a branch, right? If you look at them under the electron microscope, little branches coming off. In fact, in the literature, it talks about how we want arborization of the dendrites, arbor like a tree. So we want nice full dendrites. Well, chronic stress, high cortisol causes those to kind of get cleaved off. So there's less neural connection. Within 2 hours of that first infusion, those dendrites start forming more branches. So it's literally undoing what chronic stress has done to the brain. And I think that's what makes this therapy so impactful is it's getting the brain healthy. You know, that's what I keep telling patients. I mean, that's how we see these dramatic changes in scores in 8, 10, 21 days. It's like we're literally just getting the brain healthy. I've also heard this explanation when it comes to ketamine and other psychedelics. It's like if you were to go to a hill after it had snowed, but everybody else has been there before. So there's just a bunch of ruts and tracks, right? And so it's like in our brain, we can lay down these hardwired pathways of where we think of things. Maybe in childhood, we were told we were always inadequate or we would never do anything, or we had so much responsibility placed on us and we feel like that we fail all the time, right? So we get these ruts and the Jeep tires are stuck in the ruts. Well, what ketamine does, it comes over and it grades over the ruts. And so we can lay down new pathways. That fresh blanket of snow with the sled, now we can chart our own course and we can hardwire in different ways of viewing the world, right? So I always encourage patients that are doing ketamine therapy to do counseling alongside of it, because in my mind, as you're boosting this neuroplasticity, there's this window of opportunity where, okay, I can reframe that thing that I went through when I was 10. I can view that different. I can tell myself a different story. I think a counselor, especially someone who's trained in integration therapy with psychedelics, but even without, I think they can really help people to kind of tell themselves new stories.
What does the day that they come in for their ketamine treatment, like, how does that day unfold, and what should they expect
with it? Yeah, so we do a consultation ahead of time just to make sure that that person's a good candidate for this. People who are not good candidates, somebody who's having psychosis or mania, somebody who has schizophrenia. Ketamine does work for bipolar, but you just wouldn't want to catch a person close to that manic stage of bipolar that needs to have settled down, because it could potentially, at least theoretically, worsen that. But yeah, so you've done your consultation. We've made sure medically this is a reasonable therapy for you. But yeah, so basically we schedule the appointment for 75 minutes. Patient comes in, has an IV placed. We encourage them to download an app called Field Trip, which is designed for psychedelic journeys. It'll just kind of play music and tones, but often there's an arc to the playlist, so it kind of takes you through some different emotions. We have them bring headphones, or if they don't have them, we have some here. And then we put them in our comfortable ketamine suite where there's a reclining chair, the lights dim, we have them on the monitor. We pre-medicate with Zofran to prevent nausea, because that's a somewhat common side effect with the ketamine. Not everybody gets nauseous, but we tend to just pre-medicate people with it. And then after the 40-minute infusion, I tell them it takes them maybe 10 or 15 minutes to get their sea legs back, and then they leave with their ride. We have either the patient brings somebody with them who can sit in the room. It's like a sober sitter, or one of our staff does. It's not a safety issue so much. It's really just if the patient were to have big emotions and grief, we're trained for how to kind of step into that. And since it's on an IV, we can always pause the infusion and let the body metabolize the ketamine some to make that less intense. We usually don't even have to do that. Honestly, out of 1,300, 1,400 infusions, I think maybe 10 times or less, we've had people actually have big grief and weeping. And but it's what a layperson would say, well, that was a bad trip. We would say, no, that was a challenging journey. And it's usually the medicine saying, hey, Tobin, that thing we haven't dealt with in 15 years, we're going to start processing that. So honestly, man, every time that has happened, the patient's like, that was hard, but wow, I see how that helped. I can't wait to do my next one. You know, in the psychedelic medicine space, so there's a lot of ketamine clinics out there that will follow what we would call the biomedical model. Tobin, here's your IV, here's your infusion, there's the door, we'll see you next time. We take a psychedelic medicine approach, a spiritual approach. So we talk about set and setting. Setting is that nice, tranquil room, dimmable lights, recliner. You feel safe and comfortable. There's another person there with you sitting and holding space. But set is your intention. And we always talk to patients about that. What do you want to get out of this? What is your intention? Like, I want less anxiety. I want a longer fuse. I want insight into why I struggle with being motivated to take care of myself. Right? Those are all intentions. And I think that's really what distinguishes recreational use from therapeutic use. People can take ketamine at a rave and abuse it, and it's not like they're like, oh my gosh, my PTSD is gone, right? But the set and setting is it there. And so same thing with mushrooms. Like if you just want to take a big handful of mushrooms and walk through Times Square, tripping your face off, it's not going to have that therapeutic impact as if you go to a retreat where there's a person there giving you the medicines, coaching you about your intentions, safe setting, some integration afterwards, right? Completely different. Getting to participate in somebody getting well. Yeah. It's like the reason I went into medical school to begin with. Right. And then you just lose it in all of just the chaos of like documenting for insurance companies and hospitals looking at satisfaction scores.
I wanted to wrap up this piece with an interview with Melissa Scannell, who's a licensed mental health counselor who practices in this unique way, in a unique setting, She offers psychedelic guidance and integration therapy, which often includes accompanying her clients on their psychedelic journeys. Melissa's clients often utilize psilocybin in their healing, which is the active psychedelic ingredient in mushrooms. She works with clients to intentionally create their psychedelic experience. Their actual ingestion of the medicine usually happens in their own homes, with Melissa there as a guide. She's seen how impactful this experience has been over and over again in the spiritual growth and healing of her clients. And her passion for her work is obvious, as you'll hear. Here she is.
So I'm a 20-year licensed therapist. My specialty is complex trauma. And so I have all of these tools in my toolbox, and I was still seeing clients sometimes multiple times a week, keeping them out of acute care hospitalizations. And traditional talk therapy, like, it's great in some instances, but like really didn't provide clients the resourcing and skills and tools that they needed to stand alone. And so I fell into this magical world. So I went from seeing clients, again, sometimes 3-4 times a week, keeping them out of the hospital, to seeing people 6-8 times. So again, very, very different type of therapy. So we obviously start off with an assessment. We're assessing, you know, medical and any issues, obviously, in regards to mental health and home safety, things like that. But truly, we're starting to set intentions of what they're hoping to gain during this experience. And we're working with core emotions, right? Like fear and love. And we are guiding them in a way of understanding awareness and consciousness and what, again, this experience is going to be like. So there is some education. Obviously, there's homework, you know, things like that kind of go into it. And then we're prepping for a ceremony for each individual. And it's always very different what people are wanting, the things that bring them comfort, the things that are going to open them up into this heart space. And so the curation of this ceremony is made with them. The music, the setting, the set, all of those things are very important. And so we are prepping for this experience the first time that we begin interaction. And some people need more, like usually it's around 2 90-minute prep sessions and a 90-minute assessment. Sometimes people need more than that. It really just depends. And then we get into the day of medicine, which again is this curation of this ceremony for the person, for the individual.
Have the majority of your clients never done a psychedelic before?
Maybe it's like 50-50. Some have used recreationally when they were younger. And I've also worked with professionals who have never done any sort of psychedelic, not even cannabis. And so I think that there's the wide spectrum of both. Most of them have not used intentionally, which is very different. Like when we are asking the medicine to work with us, understanding the medicine has an intelligence, setting these intentions, the medicine works with us so much differently. This isn't right, like we're just going to a party and we're gonna dance or be with friends. This is true intention of, I am dealing with like guilt and shame that have been with me since I was a kid and I don't know how to step out of it. How do I use the medicine to release me from these experiences and to be, again, like in my wholeness in the present moment? And so it's so intentionally set so someone has the ability to let go and surrender and work through this in a way that is all within them. They're the ones doing all of this themselves. We, again, are just kind of curating and holding space in a way that feels safe for somebody.
I'm really curious, like, what that actual ceremonial day looks like.
Usually I go to somebody's house or they're renting an Airbnb and I'm meeting them there. And so some people like to be in their own home, have all of their own things. We create an altar, sacred things that we've collected along the way, pictures maybe of ourselves as a child, pictures of maybe our family, of our own children, of our parents, things like that. While we're preparing, the medicine, we talk to it, right? Like we're setting these intentions into it. It is part of our ceremony, part of what we're asking for and the intentions being set. And so for some people, they welcome the smell of sage. And so we sage, we might drum, creating just like a circle of safety and a circle of love to be surrounded with them. And some people want to pray before. Some people are very religious and they write their own ceremonial type of sermon to kind of like give before. It's been beautiful, and we pray, and that's been awesome too. And so again, for everybody, it's really different. And so it's sometimes hard to say what someone's ceremony is going to look like until you're with them and know what they are asking for. And then after the medicine's been ingested, it depends on how long, again, for each person it takes to start feeling it. And then we go into a guided meditation where I'm taking someone through like just a body relaxation, right? Like relaxing from the top of our head down into our cheeks, our mouth, our neck, again, and slowly just bringing in that feeling of relaxation, taking them into, again, like a nice, gentle space. Some people talk their entire experience. Some people are very internal, but I transcribe. So any movement somebody makes, I write down. Anything anybody says, if I say something, if they say something, again, I'm writing it down. So it's all documented. And you can see the release of energy, the body opening up, your facial expressions change, your mannerisms, the way that you hold yourself. So when people come out, their body feels different to them. They're lighter typically, the way that they hold their shoulders back, their voice sometimes, again, like all of these things change a little bit, they shift a little bit. And it's magical to watch and to see. And for them, it's so validating because it's also like, oh my God, like I just did all of that myself. And wow, like I feel so much different. It doesn't solve all the problems. It shows them about being present. And again, that these past experiences have what we've been living through. We've all been maybe living through these lenses of what happened yesterday and the day before and the day before, and all of these different constructs that have made me who I am. And so we peel back some of those layers and we get to more of our authenticity. And so they feel more like themselves. They feel more whole. They feel positive and they feel love, maybe feelings that they've not ever felt before. And then it's like, how do I keep this? How do I continue to integrate these things? How do I build those neural pathways as a licensed therapist who's worked with chronic mental health? It might make me tear starts here. The way that this medicine has brought people into a space of like healing, openness, and like love for themselves, like to say that we shouldn't be able to have access to it. So a medicine that grows in the ground is really hard for me. And so I think we just have to continue to educate around it.
In our conversation, Melissa touched more on the legality of psilocybin, which from my experience, honestly, is just a discouraging topic to dig into. But with that being said, it's worth researching the history of these policies on your own if it's a topic you're curious about. In the United States, it's classified federally as a Schedule I controlled substance, which is the highest classification, meaning it's considered to have no accepted medical use. With that being said, some cities and states have decriminalized psilocybin, meaning it's not a major priority for law enforcement in those areas. And there has been some increased interest in medical research on its therapeutic effects. To be honest, I didn't know a lot about the topic before digging into it for this piece, but I'm leaving with the desire to advocate for more fresh legislation on psilocybin and other psychedelic substances. I think it's important as a mental health professional to do so. And if you want to learn more about joining in that advocacy, check out ways to do so, either on a large scale or more locally. I think you'll find that those opportunities exist, and I think it'll be a trip worth taking.